Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So our podcast is called Right and Wrong.
So are these your notes? These are your notes about what we're going to say. What does
it
say?
I thought it would be a good... I didn't even get to idea. Okay. Maybe I can just ask you the question. Okay.
It's going well.
It's going really well. Hello and welcome to the Right and Wrong podcast. I'm Emma.
And I'm Jamie.
And just before we introduce today's guest, just to let you know, this will be one of my last podcasts, unfortunately, for a while, because I have so much going on with other projects at the moment. But you will be pleased to know that you have the wonderful Jamie to take you through the rest of our interviews for the rest of time.
That's me.
That's him.
For all eternity.
Exactly, for all of eternity. And, you know, if Jamie lets me in the future, I might jump in and out now and again. In a few interviews and hopefully be interviewed one day, Jamie. You never know.
That would be great, yeah. When your book comes out.
Exactly. You never know. But thanks. It's been so fun to do and to speak to everyone. So it is really upsetting. But hopefully I'll get to jump in now and again. So she'll be back. You know, exactly. She
get
will.
Rid of her.
Exactly. But without further ado, Jamie, would you like to introduce our wonderful guest today?
I would, yes. Today, we are joined by full-time editor and, as of this year, published author, Susan Ferber. Hello, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here today.
Oh,
thank you for coming on. Let's talk about, first things first, your debut novel, The Essence of an Hour, which came out this year. Tell us about it.
Yes, so it published in February by a small independent press called Valley Press, based up in Yorkshire. And it is a historical novel. It is set in the 1940s in upstate New York, which is where I'm from originally in America. And it is the essentially a coming of age story about a young girl named Lily Kerrigan and the year that she is 18 going on 19. And that's sort of summer of 1941 before America joined the war. She's just finished high school. She's about to go off to university. And she and her best friend have parallel great summer romances, which ends essentially in tragedy. So 10 years later, an older Lily is looking back and reflecting on what happened and trying to see her place in that narrative and understand if her actions directly led to the consequences, or she, you know, how culpable is she for what happened to her friends?
Wow. Amazing.
And intense.
Really intense. Yeah, but fabulous. How did the book come about? What inspired you to write?
So I actually wrote the first draft when I was 19. And I was sent home from university for a week because I'd come down with mono or glandular fever, as is better known in this country. And like any normal human being, once I was recovering and sitting up in bed, I decided I wanted to write a novel. And I had been having some ideas float around in my head for quite some time for this story, and I knew I wanted to write a novel about a female friendship that is quite sort of competitive. It's quite twisted, and I had read a book by Edna O'Brien called The Country Girls, which it just changed the way I saw writing and, you know, what kind of stories could be told and how you could mirror a loss of faith in the Catholic Church with a loss of innocence. So that spoke to my own personal situation. And I don't know if it's because I woke up in a delirium. I had the first, I don't know how it came, but I had the first line and I heard this heroine's voice and I just started writing it. And I understood the way I wanted it to work from that time as well, that it would always be that dual narrative of looking back 10 years and, you know, quite heavy foreshadowing throughout where she's trying to come to terms with what has happened. And so that was, as I said, that was always built into it. And I knew the ending. So the first line and the last line have never changed. A lot, obviously, otherwise has changed. One of the biggest components being that I wrote that when I was 19. And sure, I could have, you know, the 19-year-old voice sounds quite authentic, I suppose. But when she's supposed to be reflecting in her late 20s, that voice sounded eerily similar to the voice of 19 still. So it didn't have that emphasis of detachment or of, you know, sort of false maturity. So rewriting it then in my mid to late 20s, I was able to bring in that layer. But I was really glad that I had written it at 19, because I think you lose the vocabulary that you use at that age. You lose the immediacy. You don't, even your mind shifts. I think you become slightly less of a selfish person and solipsistic, but you have a way of framing the world that is just so different even from your early 20s. So I did go back to those early drafts and look and see, how is she thinking? Is that overly dramatic? Well, actually, no, that is how she would think at 18, but I need to add something where she reflects at, you know, 28, 29, thinking that is, you know, that is preposterous. I shouldn't have been thinking like that. And I would reread my old diaries as well to get a sense of, how does one speak? How did one think? And hopefully, I hope that comes across in the novel, how, you know, this is a woman who is quite lost and is trying to locate herself and locate her former self within, you know, her current self.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's been in the making for many, many years, this.
Yes. And I keep coming back to, I sort of wrote it very quickly when I was 19, and then I let it sit for years. But this heroine's voice of Lily Kerrigan, it just kept creeping back at me. And, you know, obviously, I think when one writes a first novel, especially in first person, there are, you know, obviously autobiographical details in there. There are elements in myself, but she is not me at all. And the way she speaks is not the way I speak. So it is interesting to keep coming back to her and keep thinking, you know, where is she even now? What is she doing? What does she do once the novel's over? She stayed with me. And I always wanted her to have this very caustic voice, very much in line with the Holden Caulfield, where you feel both repelled and yet entranced by this person. Yeah. And you think they're unreliable. They're probably quite nasty. She's not a likable character at all times, but I hope, and I mean, characters like that are always very divisive, but I do hope that most readers are able to see that there's a, you know, there's an empathy there, that there's a sensitivity behind that wall of sort of cold, sarcastic remarks, which she makes all of the time.
Great. It's really interesting that you said that she's kind of followed you through the ages.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Maybe she's like your alter ego.
I think so. She's much cooler than I am. I mean, you know, not like terribly. I think that is the thing. When you write a first novel, and it is to some degree based on yourself, so, you know, there are autobiographical details in there. She is, you know, she's from a similar place to where I am in America. She also grew up in a very strict Catholic, you know, society and family. So those elements I gave to her. But she evolved from there to be just so different from myself. And she's always, you know, smoking and drinking and having, you know, going to parties. And I wasn't really doing that at 18, 19.
Yeah.
Certainly not the glamorous,
not the glamorous
parties that she goes to. I think that was sort of fantastical, but it was trying to also understand, right, how would it have looked to have been 18, 19 in this different era? Mm. And I think because I was in a place where I'm from, and then where I went to university in America was a Catholic university, and it was very conservative. It felt of a different time. So when I was reading something like The Country Girls, or when I came to read The Bell Jar, which I will say I read that after I'd written the first draft, and then I thought, what's the point? She's already done it perfectly. That sort of voice. But I related so much more to that than I did to sort of teen dramas that were going on of my time, because these issues, and I was even speaking to a friend about this last night who had gone to university with me as well. And this place was a place where, you know, girls would sit around and we would, you know, they would talk about, oh, I want my husband to have this job and I want our summer home to be here. And, you know, I'm going to be married by this age. We're going to have these children. They wanted to look and do these things. And I thought, where am I? Have I taken a time machine? You know, we could do amazing things ourselves.
Exactly.
So it felt very strange. And also even things like the novel deals, quite frankly, with sex and that loss of virginity. And again, that comes from a place of what was happening in my own life when I was that age, where again, we were sitting around in these, you know, on our beds and having these conversations about, oh, well, I would never lose it unless da, da, da. And it was, you know, it was again this sort of 1940s, 1950s mentality of, oh, you save yourself. And it was ridiculous. And looking back on it, it can be quite difficult to explain to people. But that is the world I knew. And I think, you know, the novel also deals with you know, sexual assaults as well. And that was something that was, you know, happening rampantly, you know, many places, many universities, but especially where I was, because we couldn't really talk about sex. And so because we couldn't talk about sex in a, you know, a good way, in a positive way, and it was always quite in a seedy way, we weren't able to speak about sexual assault and rape and, you know, help one another through that. We you know, it felt like this, again, this society of women who sort of closed ranks on one another when you tried to speak. And I do think that is changing in the last so many years, which is really, really positive, even in these, you know, sort of more conservative sectors. But there's still quite a lot of work to do. And I'm really hoping, you know, like a novel such as this, or there's lots of other novels that are now being published, which are dealing with these subjects, will help to push that more to the light. And give young women who are in places where it's not being discussed openly access to at least experience literature and stories, and know that they're not alone. Because again, I think that would have helped me a lot when I was that age.
Oh, that's brilliant. Honestly, yes, Suzanne, honestly, it's absolutely incredible. I think young women have to have that as well. Because as you said, I think there still is a lot of work to be done, unfortunately. And I think people, although it is very progressive now, I think it's really important to have people like yourself putting these stories out there and putting young women in the forefront as well of those characters to change something about it, which is great. And I just wanted to ask something about your title, actually.
Yes.
So Essence of an Hour, it's really like quite a compelling title. How did that come about? Is that something that was in the book anyway, or?
So my editor actually found it. I will say, so I work in publishing as well, and I always tell people I'm terrible at titles. Some people can do it so quickly. You know, you give them something like, oh, go with this. So my editor had found it, and she had looked through she was reading the manuscript, and she said, this character mentions Fitzgerald a lot, so it makes sense to me that perhaps we should go with a Fitzgerald quote. Because I'd also said, to me, this novel should function as, we should pretend it was published in the 1950s and that this is Lily Kerrigan writing it, not myself. And I think she would pick a literary title, much like Fitzgerald does with Tender as the Night, which is, you know, from the John Keats poem, or, you know, lots of Shakespeare quotes become titles as well. So she had found a sort of short list of Fitzgerald quotes, and that one seemed to fit perfectly for a few reasons. One is because it's from a poem that he wrote when he was at Princeton, and it actually also appears in The Side of Paradise as well. And that was his first novel, which is, you know, again, slightly, you know, alter ego of himself, very precocious debut, which was, you know, very famous when it came out of its time. So that felt quite perfect. And also it deals with this imagery of what is lost, and there's a line in about, you know, pressing the flower, and that image does come up in the book several times, this savoring and what is lost in the savoring, that once, you know, once a moment's happened, it becomes memory and we can never you know, recover it, but we can never trust what's happened because we only have our memory to rely upon.
So true. No, it's a brilliant, really compelling title. So I was like, oh, sounds really good.
It's very in keeping with the voice of the character. I really like that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you work in publishing, you have for a while now.
Yes.
What was the process in terms of you'd written this book and then you went to Valley Press? Did you have to go on submission?
So they just had an open submission period, which was fantastic.
Okay.
But I have, I've worked in publishing, but I've never worked in literary publishing, actually. I've always kept myself quite separate from working on the side that I want to produce. I think one of the reasons is probably sheer jealousy. it's also fiercely competitive, and I think it helps to separate one's sort of personal life out from what they do in work. So I've worked in a few different sort of sectors. I started in academic sort of play publishing, and then was in business publishing for a bit, and now I'm in children's publishing. But it's always been sort of educational or nonfiction that I've gravitated toward so that I could concentrate on the more literary side when I'm writing. But Valley Press, it had an open submission window sort of in the few months leading up to COVID, and I submitted and then found out in the midst of COVID, that first lockdown, that I had been accepted. So that was terribly exciting. And it came out in, I know, it was very strange as well, because it was April Fool's Day that I received the message. I've been like most people who are writers, you submit things to lots of people for quite some time, and you're rejected, and then you get partial submissions accepted, and then and then you get rejected, or sometimes you never hear anything, and you get your hopes up so much, and then to then have it happen is it was incredible. And it's still a bit, I can't quite believe that it's out. even now, it's been several months, but it came out in February, which again was during the third lockdown, which was, it was strange as well, because I couldn't be with people. So it was just my husband and myself in my flat, having like a Zoom launch. But that was great as well, because I'm from America, it allowed me to, invite and incorporate people in my life who've been so important that, simply would never have been able to come over to London for something like this. So I do think there's a really great positive that has come out of this, with these Zoom events and, keeping it more interactive for an international audience. And it was nice though, once the lockdown lifted and I was able to go into the bookshop and see it in physical person, because I think that's in my mind's eye what I'd always imagined growing up as a little girl. I was like, oh, I'm gonna run to the shop and there it's going to be on the shelf. But it is funny, because I work in publishing as well, there's some tricks of the trade I know as well. So people were messaging me saying, why have I pre-ordered the book and now I'm receiving it in January, but it doesn't come out till February? And I would say, well, that's because if stock's available, unless the book is embargoed, and very few books are ever embargoed, they have to be the new Margaret Atwood or the new, sort of big title. Because bookshops don't like it. So it has to be, publishers have to be very selective when they do it. But then, the book will sort of have a soft launch and start be appearing in bookshops. So it isn't usually that magical moment of, 9 a.m. the bookshop opens on the day it's published and it's there for the first time. And of course that does happen with some books. But it was nice to be able to explain that to people, because that is one of the biggest questions I've answered over the years for authors of, why is my book already in the shop? I didn't think it was publishing till next month. So it was nice to have that,
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Knowledge.
Oh, that's brilliant. And you've had quite the educational journey throughout your life. You've studied literature and travelled and studied internationally as well. And obviously you studied philosophy as well. Can you let us know how this maybe helped you write?
Yeah, so I think I had studied English and philosophy at university, and it definitely, the philosophy helped because I'm actually terrible at philosophy.
Great.
My philosophy professor told me, in a sense of, you know, I do not have the sort of analytical, logical mind of what makes a great philosopher. But there's also, you know, a different discipline of philosophy, which is what I was very attracted to, of the more literary side. So that's more the tradition of existentialism and Camus, and, you know, Simone de Beauvoir, who is my hero, and also Plato in many ways, that this is more, there's a literary turn to it, that's what I love about philosophy, is when it goes away from being these tracts, which are very, you know, only to really be read by people who are in the know about that, to more open, to anybody can read it. So again, thinking about Simone de Beauvoir, she wrote novels which are, they are philosophical, and they are, you know, very openly feminist and, you know, discussing ideas, but ultimately they're also a novel. So that framed what I wanted to write, to make it have that sort of meat of being based in philosophy. And as I said, I was at a Catholic university, so you have to study philosophy when you're at a Catholic university, at least for sort of introduction courses. And yeah, also you have to, it's so that you can prove the existence of God, basically. That's why you do it. Seriously. And so there's also a lot of St. Augustine and Aquinas in there as well. So I think that really informed me, and just the way I think. And that's something that I can never, even though I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, that sort of way that your mind has been formed is difficult to detach yourself from. So this idea of sin and culpability. So that helped me write the novel as well, and think, right, this is a girl who is also trying to break away from the church, but how can she unlearn, you know, thinking about the world through the St. Augustine lens, and which also goes back to Plato in a way too. So that is definitely there. But also you mentioned the international scope as well. So then when I was a university student in America, my professor, it was actually through the philosophy department that they recommended that I go to Oxford for a year to study. And that's why I now live here. and I'd been outside the country, but it's not really fair. I grew up next to the Canadian border. So that's not, it's, you know, it's not really particularly international travel if you're next to it. But I had never really left the country before. So it was my first international flight. And, you know, it opened my eyes, and it's, you know, it was incredible to live in a different society. But, you know, to see the similarities between America and, you know, the UK, and I think they are becoming much, much more similar, alarmingly so. And yeah, I think that's one of the things I'm probably interested in exploring more in future novels, is that sort of transatlantic, you know, narrative, and how similar they are as countries, and that sort of loss, you know, ness that comes with that.
Yes.
Yeah.
What do they call it? The special relationship.
The special friendship or something. Special relationship. I know, it's very bizarre. But even, I mean, this sounds quite, you know, sort of colloquial, but even things like when I first came over 9 years ago, I would go to the to the shop to buy groceries, and I simply couldn't get, you know, I had to learn how to bake from scratch then, because you couldn't get all these mixes, which in America you go into a grocery store and you have like 50 different prepackaged Betty Crocker mixes. And in the UK, you just didn't have that. So I learned to bake from scratch. Yeah. And now I go in and there's not 50, but, you know, there definitely, it has expanded from, you know, two or three. And so now I think there's like 10 or something. So I see, I mean, that's a really strange way of explaining it.
No, it's true though. It is true.
It's that sort of, ooh, America is continually creeping in, I think, getting its yeah. sort of ways.
Yeah, definitely. I think I was amazed when I first went to LA. The supermarket was like just an absolute playground for me. It was just like the amount of, there was a whole aisle just dedicated to cheese. And I was like, this is incredible. Like there were so many different types of cheese. I was just like, there's squeezy cheese. I think it was amazing. And over here, it just wasn't the same. You couldn't get as much, or there wasn't as much variety. Yeah. And now it's sort of, yeah, as you said, it's creeping in there as well. But to go back to your writing, you mentioned and less about cheese. Yeah. you mentioned that you potentially in other novels, or when writing novels in the future, you'd want to talk about X, Y, and Z. Are you currently writing a second novel at the moment? Is that something that you're working on?
Yes, I am. I am working. I am on a second draft. I'm hoping it does not take 10 years again.
I thought that was part of the process. It was all
planned. Exactly.
So I am. And it is exhilarating working on a second novel. And, you know, it's obviously, it's a bit scary because you do think, right, am I... You know, was it just freshman luck? Was it, you know, that sort of everything inside of me, I did it once, can I do it again? Mm-hmm. So I think it is giving yourself much more discipline to do it a second time. But also there's a confidence, I think, that comes with having been published, which sounds ridiculous and silly, but it does give you a validation. And it does say,
of course.
It moves you. And I'm still moving into this sort of mental, idea of, right, I can consider myself a writer now. This isn't, you know, just a hobby that I scribble away when I get home from work. I can take this very seriously. And that shift in telling myself, yes, you can do that and you should be doing that, has been something I've been working through for the last year. But it's wonderful when it is happening. It obviously is, and I'm sure many people that you've interviewed and people listening will, you know, relate to this. It is difficult to write when you're working full time. And the way I do it is I just have to have a structure. So if you keep missing days, then you get this feeling of, right, now I only have 2 hours and I have to, you know, be the best writer ever in these 2 hours because I haven't written in several weeks and this is it. Yeah. And sometimes that you might put that on a Saturday or Sunday, and it's just so pressurizing and no good writing is going to come from that. So if you develop a routine, and sometimes the routine I have at the moment, because of work, because commuting's opening back up as well now, you know, sometimes it is 15 minutes. But even if I only get that 15 minutes of an evening, I have to do something because it keeps you warm.
Yeah.
So that when you do have a longer stint, you can dive back in. Because the sort of the first few minutes or sometimes the first few hours of writing can be, you know, pulling teeth. But once you get into a pace of it and you get rid of that self-doubt and that self-hatred saying you can't do this, because that's a huge part of it as well, is combating that. And you just get into writing in your zone. I think you kind of get into the flow of creation. Yeah. And that's certainly happened on the first draft of what I'm writing at the moment. But, you know, going back and doing the second draft, I think working as an editor is a unique position as well, because lots of people, especially some of the books I've worked on previously, like a business book, people were really only writing one draft, and the second draft of them is, you know, changing a comma or changing a word. And that's
lucky them.
Yes. Yeah. And they're like, oh, I hope the book's okay. And you're like, you know, well, you only wrote one draft of it, but okay, that's fine. I'll write the second draft for you. So I think people have a misconception, or you watch a film and there's a writer in it, or even you read a book that a writer is writing and they know the process. They somehow still magically do it in one draft.
Films always do it wrong, and I'm always triggered. Watch, and I'm like, that's not how it
triggered
works. Like, this is not how the industry works.
I know, they always like type the end and then it's like, you know, rushed out to the printer and it's on the shelf the next day. So I think it is understanding, right, a second draft, a third draft, you know, subsequent drafts, they are, there's a lot of heavy lifting. Actually, a lot of the writing takes place during those drafts of redeveloping. For me, I mean, different writers work different ways. I mean, I've listened to Alan Hollinghurst speak about the way he writes, and he writes, I think, quite meticulously, where he takes years to write a novel and he painfully labors over every scene so that he can do it actually in very few drafts because he's doing a lot of the work then. I'm of the sort of, the way I do it is I have to write very, very fast and I have to get it out there, and I have to not plan too much on that first draft so that I can see the way characters explode and that they go off on one another. I really like dialogue as well, so it's getting a sense of, you know, how would people speak to each other. If I'm starting a scene, I have no idea sometimes where it's going to go, so in those next few drafts it's, you know, getting that maintenance into it, thinking, was that the right thing? You know, are the people being too repetitive? Are people's speech patterns too similar to one another? Is one thing I look for a lot. But also, you know, kind of, I'll have a sense of what characters' backstories are. But often I'm waiting for them to reveal to me what's important to them. And then I go back and I make, I usually write, so for this particular novel, I would write out diary entries from the other characters as well. So I could get a sense of, you know, who they were. I think that's a difficult part about first person narration is sometimes people think it's easier because they think it's just stream of consciousness. You're just writing out your own story. And that'd be very boring if it was that. And it would, you know, suffer as a novel because you're, even in this particular case, this heroine is very self-absorbed. She, probably her flaw is that she's unable to understand other people. She's unable to let in the fact that they are as complex of human beings as she is. So I have to know, though, that they are complex human beings. So when she says something about them, I know the truth behind that. And I have to know in my mind, right, if the novel was written from this character's perspective, how would it read differently to how it's currently written?
Yeah. Right. That makes sense.
Yeah, a lot of sense.
And speaking of, we've spoken a lot about your book and your writing and things like that. Only a little bit about your work as an editor.
Yes.
If it's a very competitive area of publishing, and if people listening were interested in becoming an editor, what advice would you give them for that career path?
I think if you want to be an editor, you have to know why you want to be an editor. And again, this goes back to this sort of fictional idea I think people have of an editor being the Maxwell Perkins with Fitzgerald and Hemingway and, you know, igniting their genius. That most of the time is not what it looks like to be an editor. And there are different types of editors, actually. And I started off on a path to be a commissioning editor, mostly. And that is when you are looking at bringing in new manuscripts and signing off and signing people up. Right. And that can be, you know, that's more what editing is now. And lots of people love that. But I really like the desk editing side of it, where you are sitting down and working very firmly with an author or, you know, your sort of editorial and design team to make that book come to fruition and, you know, editing at every stage. And you get much more hands-on with the text. If you work for a smaller press, you may do all of those jobs. You may wear every single hat. And I have done that before. I've also sold foreign rights. I've done a lot in sort of smaller places. And I think that probably is a good bit of advice is understand why you want to be an editor and what you want to do. Do you want to be an editor because you want to work with language? Do you want to be an editor because you want to work with authors? Perhaps you want to do both. And understand that it's not a career simply because you love books. You have to understand that if you love books, publishing will kill your love of books usually. So you have to go in with so I've always thought, well, I love books, but if I have to work in business, I want to work on a product that I do love and I believe in and I want to get out there in the world. So understand that, I believe, and then also be really open. And I think especially sometimes young people trying to get into publishing, they don't understand how many publishers there are. And they think that there's Random House and Penguin and Faber, or in America, Simon & Schuster, which perhaps won't be around for much longer. Who knows what will happen there? So, and then there's the dream job. And those jobs are very, very competitive. And, you know, I've worked in jobs before where you do feel like anybody could do this job, and it's so competitive for, you know, a certain type of person. And the minute you leave, they'll just get your, you know, sort of replacement in. It feels a bit like All About Eve. It's a bit creepy. I think it can be a really great thing to start by working at smaller presses, because, as I said, you could get every sort of experience at a smaller press. And you probably will rise the ranks a little bit faster and have a little bit more autonomy quickly, because you'll be able to, you'll essentially just be needed at lots of different stages. So that's a great way. And just being open to working on a list that you may not be your dream list, and taking those skills, because every bit of experience is helpful to getting your foot in the door and moving you along to hopefully getting your dream job, I would say, in the future.
Yeah.
That's really great advice. No, thank you. That's brilliant advice. And I have one final question, which is a really, well, I think it's an exciting question. And also my favorite question to ask everyone. So if you were to be marooned on a desert island with nothing but a book to provide you with love and entertainment, what would that book be, and why?
So I thought about this, and gosh, I'll have to go with Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think because, one, it's a book I can't quite read in a day, so I think that's important. I think it has to be. It's a little bit too long to read in a day. But I have read it twice, and I've watched the mini series with Jeremy Irons many times. Yeah. So I know. I do not tire of it. I go back, and each time I find something new in it. And that was such a huge inspiration to me writing this book. And I also should say, I don't even like Evelyn Waugh as a writer and any other book either. So it's strange that this book speaks to me so much, but it is about, you know, a very messy Catholic family. So that I find that interesting. I find it interesting how these characters do gravitate toward the church, toward the end of the book. So that I get something out of, and I think I'll probably get more out of that when I'm older as well, trying to understand why a certain character goes back to the church on his deathbed. But also, I think as a stylist, as a writer, it's you know, fascinating to understand how he plays those tricks with the narrative. So every time I read it, I think the tragedy won't happen. I think, you know, Sebastian will not descend into alcoholism. I think that, you know, maybe Julia and Charles will you know, have a happy ending. And I don't think it's spoiling to say those things, because you know that from the first chapter that things are not going to end well, that this is a man who is coming back to this place for a third time in his life. But you forget that, and you keep thinking, oh, maybe things will work out. So I think it's how does he do that? How does he suspend you that even when you know it, you believe in it? And those characters are so lovable. So I think I could quite happily read that again and again for the rest of my life and still learn as a writer from reading it.
Sounds like it appeals to you as a writer and as an editor in the it's laid out.
But as I said, it is strange, because I don't like Evelyn Waugh's other novels, and I think it's one of the best novels of the 20th century.
It's a classic.
It is a classic.
He didn't like it then after it was published, because he saw it as so different from his other work. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah,
that's a good thing. Yeah.
Well, amazing. Yeah, definitely. I love it when we get classics on the Desert Island list. It's a really good answer, and it's a great book. Thank you so much for coming on, Susan, and sharing your experience and your journey with us. For anyone listening, if you want to keep up with everything that Susan is doing, you can follow her on Instagram at Susan Ferber Writes, and you can get the book Essence of an Hour. It's out now. Get it in all the usual places: Waterstones, Amazon, Foyles, everywhere. To make sure you don't miss an episode of this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter at Right and Wrong UK and on Instagram at Right and Wrong podcast. Thanks again, Susan. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Susan. It's been brilliant.
And thanks to everyone listening. We will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.